Welcome to Let My People Think, the weekly program featuring speeches, lectures, and sermons by international Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias. Our program format today is a bit different from what is normally featured each week. Today you will hear from not only Ravi Zacharias, but also from another Christian apologist, Dr. William Lane Craig. In 1997, Ravi and Dr. Craig had the privilege of participating in a conference held on the campus of the University of Iowa, where they were asked to respond to the top five questions that university students ask about Christianity. On today's broadcast, Ravi and Dr. Craig answer what is perhaps the most asked question of all time. What is the meaning of life? Life's meaning has been the pursuit of innumerable philosophers, theologians, and thinkers through the ages, and it has been a foundational question in the life of most people. But what do we mean when we ask, what is the meaning of life? We're asking if life has any purpose, any goal. Indeed, we all answer this question one way or another, even if we decide life has no meaning. Here's Ravi and Dr. Craig to offer their answer to this vital question.
The top five questions that we gathered, we actually had, among other things, over 900 hits on the email. So there were a lot of different questions, and even though many of the questions were phrased in slightly different ways, they tended to fall, at least the majority of them, into five broad basic categories of questions. And so we've rephrased the questions a little bit so that it tries to meet those five main areas. In addressing the questions, Dr. Zacharias is going to go first, followed by Dr. Craig, and they'll switch off every other question. But with each question, each speaker will address them, with the first speaker speaking 10 minutes and the second speaker giving an additional two-minute commentary. The number one question that University of Iowa students asked about Christianity is one that's pretty broad. That's the question, what is the meaning of life? How do we know if there is any meaning of life, and what would the basis or foundation be for asserting that there was a meaning? The number two question is a question concerning the existence of God, namely, how can we know that the Christian God even exists? What reasons or evidence are there for thinking that there is a being such as God? The number three question deals with the problem of evil. How can the Christian God, who, according to the Bible, is all-powerful and all-good, allow such injustices as the Holocaust or various natural disasters to occur? The fourth question is a question concerning the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. How can we know that the resurrection of Jesus Christ really occurred and wasn't instead a legend that was made up by some of his followers as a way to start Christianity as a movement later on? And the last question is a question having to do with the exclusive claims of the Christian gospel. Christians claim that only those who place their faith in Jesus of Nazareth will attain salvation. So the question is, how can this be fair to the millions of people, both in historical past and in the world today, that are Hindus or Muslims or atheists, for that matter, that are good people? How is the justice of God embodied in that? So with that, I will hand the mic over to Dr. Ravi Zacharias.
Thank you very much, and it really is a delight to be here, although I'd rather be sitting where you are, listening to the answers, than standing up here purporting to give some profound new insight to age-old questions. I couldn't help but thinking, as the questions were being narrated to you and watching the expression on your faces, wondering, is this what we're going to get answers to tonight? I remember when I was in graduate school, doing my doctrinal examination for the denomination with which I'm affiliated, and the opening question was, God is perfect, explain. And I turned to my wife and said, about the only more difficult question I could think of would be, define God and give two examples. Now, the marvelous thing about that question was that there was just this much space in which to do the answering, and therefore the possibility of heresy was minimized. But we are dealing with some very, very tough issues here. We wrestle with them. We think about them. Even at this stage in my life, while I literally crisscross around the globe and have done so for the last 25 years now, these questions are often in my mind when I'm sitting in a plane trying to work through a new approach to these struggles, because they are legitimate. And I believe it was Voltaire who once said that all of humanity's miseries are further a reflection of its grandeur. Because of who we are in the grandness of our thinking, we are even able to discuss our miseries with some sense of reason. And the reason we raise those issues is because we look for coherence in our lives and something that would point us to a valid conclusion about who we are and why we are here. If you are to take all of the questions that ultimately come before you, you will find this, that they are reduced to four. There may be nuances or offshoots of them. I have concluded that fundamentally there are four: questions of origin, questions of meaning, questions of morality, and questions of destiny. Origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And it's interesting that those four questions are somehow hinted at here. Please bear in mind one other thing, that when a question such as this is raised, it is not only for the Christian to attempt an answer. A Hindu, for example, has to give an answer to these same questions. So does a Muslim. So does a skeptic. And what you have to recognize is that when you give answers to those questions, that your worldview provides the coherence for those four issues of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. It's not good enough to be right on one and wrong on the other three. Individually, the answers must correspond to truth, and then corporately, there must be a coherence in those answers. If you follow what I'm saying, someone might give you a very clever answer on meaning, but does it tie in with that person's philosophy of origin or that person's philosophy of destiny? Aldous Huxley, for example, in his book Ends and Means, made the comment. He said, "I want this world not to have meaning. I want this world not to have meaning because it frees me to my own erotic and my own political pursuits." The breakdown of meaning lent itself to an autonomous lifestyle and all the indulgence with which he wanted to live. So let me give to you a summary answer. Obviously, in a few minutes, we can't give you a comprehensive one. But I was just checking through, because the book was released about 3 years ago. In the second half of the book, Can Man Live Without God?, I have dealt with the question of meaning, and that was a lecture delivered at Ohio State. But let me tell you how I have approached this subject, since it is an existential one. The logical basis will emerge in the other questions. I believe there are four components that a person must have in order to say my life is meaningful. Now, you will have to bear with me, because as soon as I begin, you're going to say, where is he going with this answer? Because there may be a struggle you may have with the first thought, but give me a hearing till I pull the four of them together. Shakespeare is the one who said in As You Like It that all the world's a stage and the men and women are merely actors. They have their entrances and their exits, and each one in his life plays many parts. He takes you from infancy to schoolboy to soldier to middle age, all the way to old age, sans teeth, sans life, sans everything, as he said. But after you live through those stages, you realize that there is a part that you have played, so said Shakespeare. Let me take you through four stages that an average human being will live through to show you how this concept of meaning emerges in the Christian life. When you are a child, when you were a child, what is it that brings a little child meaning? Because a child lives with a world of enchantment, a world of wonder, a world of enthrallment, a world that wows that little one. You can take a one-year-old and put that one-year-old on your lap and just press a button and a ping sound comes out of it, and the child's eyes just get wide. It is getting involved with a new world, and the enthrallment is absolutely awesome to that little one. I remember talking to a very well-known Christian musician, Steve Green, and he had just become a new father. And about a year after that, when I met him, I said, "What's so exciting about being a new dad?" He said, watching the wow expression on my child's face whenever anything new is introduced. G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis were masters at understanding the world of imagination in the life of a child. And Chesterton is the one who said that he came to more of his conclusions in life from observing children than from any volume in philosophy he had ever read. And in his book, Orthodoxy, he has an extraordinary chapter called The Ethics of Elfland. If you haven't read that book, Orthodoxy, I urge you to pick it up. I think it's one of the greatest pieces of work ever written, The Ethics of Elfland. And in that, he makes this comment. He said, have you ever seen, when you're reading a fairy story to a child, that at some point you may read something like this? You may say, and the fairy godmother said to so-and-so, if you do not come back by 12 o'clock, you will become a pumpkin. He says, do you notice two things in every fairy story? Number one, there's always a condition. If you do not come by such and such, you will become a such and such. But have you noticed the child never says to the fairy godmother, how come? And Chesterton says the reason is, if you say to the fairy godmother, how come? The fairy godmother might well turn to you and say, if that's the way you want it, tell me how come there is a fairyland in the first place. That's the point I think God was making with Job. When Job was saying, only that which I can comprehensively understand in my mind will I fully accept. And God says, all right, Job, since you want that kind of comprehensive understanding, tell me, where were you when the foundations of the earth were laid? Where were you when such and such happened? He nailed Job with 64 questions back to back to show him that the many wonderful concepts he had imbibed, he did not have a full and a comprehensive understanding of those. This sense of wonder in childhood is vital for that child's meaning and the sense of awe that'll hold that young life. I was introduced to that with my little boy Nathan when he was fairly young. One day he was playing with a helium balloon in our living room, and he would leave that helium balloon and it would go up to the ceiling. He would jump up on the sofa, grab the string and pull it down, get off the sofa, leave it again, watch it go to the ceiling, jump up on the sofa, grab the string and pull it down. I think it is Chesterton who said, part of a child's infinity in capacity to enjoyment is reflected in its ability to enjoy the repetitive and the monotonous. You throw a child into the air, what does it say? Do it again, do it again. So let the balloon, it goes to the ceiling, jump on the sofa, grab the thread, bring it down. He did this a dozen times, and then even his monotony was wearing thin. He decided to go outside and let it go. And now it was gone. And all of a sudden, just complete despondency overcame him. And he was crying his heart out when he saw me coming out, watching that balloon way up there. As soon as I came out, he stopped and said, I know what, Daddy, just next time you're on the plane, you can bring it back for me. And the worst thing I could have told him was, they don't open the door when you're up there for me to reach out and bring it back. That world of wonder, we all go through that. But that's when you come to a sudden stop at a certain stage and you know the fairy stories are just that. They are merely fantastic. When you come into your youth, there is a second component that you look for, and that is the component of truth. How do I know what is true? How do I put my life in trust of that which is true? I remember being at a court case in the Old Bailey where two young girls had charged an older man with having raped them. And we were sitting there watching this in London, overwhelmed by the fact that this man had subjected these two girls, about 12 and 13, to that horrid experience. And as we listened to the testimony they were giving, and they weren't in the courtroom because they were minors, it was coming through the medium of television screens. But the man charged was sitting in the room. And then the person defending the man stood up and he said to the two young women, he said, I have some questions and I only want one thing from you. Please believe me, I want the truth. Nothing more, nothing less. If what you're telling us is the truth, we want to charge this man. But if what you're telling us is a lie, then we want to find that out also. Please tell us the truth when we ask you. If you don't understand the questions, we will explain them to you. And patiently he began to probe, one question after another. And all of a sudden he threw one little question in. And he said this, he said, "Isn't it true that you told your parents about 2 months after you actually said this incident happened?" And the two girls sort of struggled with that and said, "Yes, that is correct." And then he said, "Tell us, on the day that you told your parents, weren't you in a bus earlier on in the afternoon? And this man came over to where you were seated. He saw you up to a certain mischief that he challenged you with and told you he was coming to your home that evening to tell your parents that he saw what you were doing that afternoon. Did that happen that day?" There was silence. And one of the young girls said, "I can't remember." And the other one just refused to answer. Question after question came, and I had my daughter with me. She was not even in high school then. And the reason we were there was because she was interested in studying law. And my colleague who's here with me tonight was with us in that courtroom. And about five of us walked out of there. I have never felt so frustrated in my life, because we walked out of there in the middle when the testimony was getting more and more graphic. And the question in our mind was, what is the truth here? Because if those two girls were telling the truth, there was a wretched individual sitting there who needed to be dealt with. But if he was being framed for some other reason, there was an indelible mark going to be put on that individual's life. And the horrible thing you felt was, how will I ever know what happened here? Ladies and gentlemen, if in one incident like that in life it is important to know the truth, how much more it is for life itself. And what is it that brings life meaning? We can go through the days of infancy with wonder, but then we've got to find out what is true. Who made me? Why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? Thirdly, it is the sense of love and belongingness. Wonder, truth, love, and belongingness. Let me just say this, that sense of belongingness is so real, and that longing for belongingness is a hunger imprinted upon our hearts. If there was anything the story of Princess Diana told this world, it was the longing for acceptance and the longing to find love. And if it was anything Mother Teresa's life told us, it was the love and acceptance she gave to the most destitute on the streets and gave them a sense of belongingness. We hunger for this. Even Bertrand Russell said, out of the three great longings in his life, this one was the most unfulfilled, the longing for love and the longing to belong. So what brings life meaning? The three components I've given to you: wonder, truth, love, and lastly, security when we get to old age. In our infancy, the sense of wonder. In our youth, the understanding of truth. In our middle years, the experience of love. And in our old age, the confidence of security. And we have found out through life that many of the things we give to each other as security do not really add up to much. We want a beyond, something that goes beyond these 80 years. My time is up, and so let me just summarize it with this simple little illustration that I borrow from Chesterton again. And I apply it in my own life. When my little children were, three of my children, who are now 22, 19, and 16, if I were to take you to their lives, say at the age of 6, 3, and 1, or 7, 4, and 1, and I were to tell them the same fairy story, if I were to tell the 7-year-old something like this: little Tommy got up and walked up to the door, and Tommy opened the door, and a lion jumped in front of Tommy. All of a sudden, my 7-year-old's eyes would have become wide. Had I told my 4-year-old, Naomi, say, "Nimmy, Tommy walked up to the door, and Tommy opened the door," Nimmy's eyes would have become wide. If I had looked at Nathan at age 1 and said, "Nate, little Tommy got up and walked up to the door," Nathan's eyes would have become wide. What's the difference? At age 7, Sarah needed the dragon or the lion to jump up there. At age 4, it was all you needed, the suspense to open the door and wonder what was going to jump up in front of you. At age 1, it's a pretty big deal just to walk up to the door. The older you get, the more it takes to fill your heart with wonder, and only God is big enough to fill it. Meaning comes from wonder, truth, love, and security. And God, who's the perpetual novelty, who gave us a Son, who's the way, the truth, and the life, who loved you and gave himself for you on the cross, and says, because I live, you shall live also. That's when meaning comes in, when these four components deal with the questions of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny, and bring that coherence into your life. Thank you.
As I explained to the folks to whom I spoke last night, I'm still recovering from a bout with the flu, and so my voice is somewhat hoarse, and I just beg you to give me your indulgence. I think I can be understood by the use of this microphone tonight, however. I want to thank the Veritas Forum for allowing me also to participate in the forum. It's been a delight to be here, and especially a privilege to share the platform with Ravi tonight. As someone raised in a non-Christian home, I struggled as a teenager with the issue of meaning to life. And it seemed to me that there are two fundamental prerequisites if life is to have meaning. And those two prerequisites are God and immortality. If there is no God and immortality, then it seems to me that life ultimately becomes absurd. Because then life ends simply in death, and there is no transcendent to infuse meaning into the lives that we do have. It seems to me that life ultimately becomes without significance, without value, and without purpose. I remember the first time that my father told me as a little boy that someday I was going to die. Somehow the thought had just never occurred to me. But when he told me that, it filled me with terrible sadness and horror, and I just cried and cried and cried. He tried to comfort me by saying that my death was a long way off, but somehow that didn't seem to matter. In time, of course, I grew used to the fact and managed to live with it. But reading later in life the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, I think I realized that the child's insight was the correct one. Sartre said, whether it's a few hours or a few years makes no difference once you have lost eternity. And I think that's very true. If all we do is live to die, then ultimately our lives have no more significance than a barnyard of pigs or a swarm of mosquitoes. If we live merely to die, then our lives ultimately have no purpose. All of the achievements of mankind, all of the sacrifices, all of the great things are ultimately buried in the midst of a universe in ruins. It ultimately makes no difference. Our lives are ultimately without value. Why live as a Mother Teresa rather than as a Stalin or as a Hitler? Ultimately, everyone's fate is the same, and the contributions that good people make ultimately make no difference to the fate of the universe. But it's not just immortality that we need, I think, if our lives are to be significant. It's also God. Because if we have mere immortality but without God, there is no one to say what is the absolute standard of right and wrong, of good and evil. We would still be purposeless byproducts of the matter plus time plus chance, with no reason for living. There still wouldn't be any ultimate significance to our lives, just in virtue of its having infinite duration. But if God exists, then as in the Christian world and life view, our lives here on earth are infused with an eternal significance, because our end is not death, it is eternal life, to know God and enjoy Him forever. And there is an absolute standard of right and wrong in God Himself and His nature, and that makes the moral choices that we make in this life tremendously significant. And so basically I found in the Christian world and life view those necessary prerequisites for meaning to life, namely God and immortality.
That was Dr. William Lane Craig, who teamed up with Ravi Zacharias at a conference held on the campus of the University of Iowa. Today, the apologists were answering the question, what is the meaning of life? Let's review what they had to say. Ravi said that meaning in life comes when we have wonder, truth, love, and security. All of these are bound up in knowing God, for God gives a sense of wonder at His power, truth for us to live by, love to fill our longing hearts, and the security of knowing that we will be with Him forever in heaven. Dr. Craig reminded us that for life to have any meaning at all, it must come from God. Please tune in again next week as the speakers answer more of the top five questions. Today's broadcast, The Top Five Questions, is available through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries as part of a two-tape album. The album features the complete responses of Dr. Zacharias and Dr. William Lane Craig to the top five questions asked by university students about Christianity. It also features an open session in which the speakers answer questions from the audience. When ordering, ask for tape number CA210, The Top Five Questions. That's CA210, The Top Five Questions. If you listen in the United States, place your credit card order by calling 1-800-448-6766. That's 1-800-448-6766. The order line is available 24 hours a day. When you place your order, ask for your free copy of Ravi's newsletter, Just Thinking. The newsletter contains articles by Ravi and members of his ministry team that can be a helpful tool for understanding the issues of our day. To order online, go to rzim.org. That's rzim.org. There you'll find information about Ravi's ministry, essays and articles, and archived files of the Let My People Think broadcasts. The Online Resource Center is an interactive, user-friendly way to preview and order resources. Once again, that's rzim.org. If you prefer to write, address your envelope to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. That's RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. In Canada, contact our office there at 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. That's RZIM 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. We at Ravi Zacharias International Ministries are also excited to tell you about a line of apologetic resources that we have available. We have partnered with respected authors in various fields to develop a line of booklets called the Critical Questions Booklet Series. The booklets are uniquely and specifically designed for those who have questions about and even difficulties with belief in God and the Christian faith. The 64-page format allows for a succinct examination of the issues. To learn more about the booklets, call us at 1-800-448-6766 or visit us on the web at rzim.org. Please be sure to give us the call letters of the station when you contact us. Knowing which station you're listening to can help us better evaluate the effectiveness of the broadcast. This weekly program, Let My People Think, is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.